You're on.
Looks like you got it. Thanks, Tom. Thank you so much. Well, good morning, men. What a joy. What a joy to look out over this room and see so many friendly faces, people, some of you I've known for a long time, some of you I've met today, but in traveling around the country for this ministry called CBMC, I've had the good fortune of speaking a great deal over the last 17 years, and it is always nice to come back to Chattanooga and to see my friends here. You know, I want to do something I've never done before when I've spoken. I want to ask everyone on my CBMC national team to stand. Would you all stand? These are the people I get to work with on a daily basis. John, Mark. Now, keep standing. I'd like to ask all the local CBMC team to stand. Everyone who worked so hard to put these lunches and the prayer breakfast together, if you're on this local team, would you please stand? And now I'd like all of you who have been impacted in some way by this ministry to please stand. If you have been impacted. Wow. So for those of you who are still seated, if you'd look around this room and see the impact that this ministry has had on so many, it is really something. Thank you. You may be seated. Wow. Surrounded by men who get it. Men who were at one time where I was at one time. I want to begin today, turn some things around. I want to begin today because it's the question that is most asked when I speak. What was your greatest moment in sports broadcasting? So I'm going to begin with that rather than end with that. It happened when I was living in San Diego. In fact, speaking of San Diego, a man came up to me about a half hour ago, and he points to his name tag and he says, "You recognize this name?" And I went, "Gosh, I'm sorry, no." And he said, "I bought your condo in 1981 on Donington Way in San Diego." And his name is Roy Torr. He's right there. What a surprise, Roy. My goodness. I hadn't seen Roy since 1981, since he signed the condo over to you. And to have somebody walking back into your life after 40 years is pretty amazing. So what a joy. Thanks, Roy. Thank you so much. So this event that I'm about to describe happened while I was doing sports in San Diego for old Channel 39. It was a UHF station that now is called Channel 7. And that TV station at the time was called KCST. Roy's the only one in this room that probably would remember that. But I was sports director there, and we had just gotten a mobile van in 1982-83. It was a brand new mobile van that allowed us to go live from anywhere in Southern California. Now, every station has them now. Every station here in Chattanooga's got them. But in 1982-83, they were pretty novel. So we were always looking for some story to do to showcase our new toy. We were the first station in San Diego to have the new toy. So I said to our news director, "Hey, the Muhammad Ali boxing team is coming to San Diego in a week or two. Why don't we go live from the sports arena if Ali is here?" And Tom Mitchell looks at me and he goes, "You really think Muhammad Ali is going to come down here and watch his boxing team?" I said, "I don't know, but I'm going to find out." And he said, "I'll tell you what. If you can get Muhammad Ali live, we'll dedicate the live unit to you." Well, that's all I need is a challenge. So I start making a few phone calls, and the old saying goes, you're only 5 phone calls away from getting in touch with the President of the United States. I'm not sure I'd want to do that. But I did begin the call process of trying to get in touch with Muhammad Ali, and I got in touch with his people. Told him who I was, what we wanted to do, asked if he was going to be in San Diego that Friday night. They said, "Yes, he is." I said, "Would he agree to a live interview?" And they said, "Can we call you back?" I said, "Sure." About 45 minutes later, I get a call back. By the way, these are back in the days when people answered phones. What is up with that? And so, lo and behold, Ali said, "Yes, I'd be happy to do it." So, Friday gets here, we take our van down to the sports arena. It's empty. It's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The event's not taking place till 8 o'clock in the evening. So naturally, nobody's there. The doors aren't open. We came in the back door, and they knew we were coming. We were setting up for this live unit. We're pulling all the cables from the van, setting up the TV camera. And 4 o'clock turns into 5 o'clock. We're getting everything wired. And I'm getting all wired up with the headset so I can hear the news anchor back at Channel 39 when he throws it to me. I can say, thanks, Paul, and off I go. And so this is all going smooth, really smooth. Now follow me on this. Can't walk away from this mic because I'm hardwired. But this is the sports arena right here. And these are all rows of seats going this way. And the ring is behind me. It's about 10 feet behind me. So there's a couple more rows of seats behind me. And those are like $400 a piece if you want to buy it for the event. So I said to Dave Smith, let's set up right here. I'll be in between these rows of seats. Ali will walk in from here, and your camera will be about where you're sitting. And so he sets the lights up. We're getting all ready to go. And kind of exciting, 5:30, 5:45, and suddenly I look over to my right, and I see Ali shuffling in with a couple of his people. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness. This is going to be one of the highlights of my life. And so he keeps moving forward, and he walks over and he extends his hand. And I said, Muhammad, I'm Phil Stone with KCS-TV. It is truly an honor to meet you. And he says, as it should be. And I thought, here we go. Here we go. As it should be. And I said, it truly is. I said, I've been doing sports a while, and this is the high water mark for me. And he said, I imagine it is. So I said, we're about 5-6 minutes away from going live. I see your boxing team over there. If you'd like to go visit with them, or you can stay right here. He said, I'll walk right over here for a few minutes, and you just raise your hand, and I'll come back over. And so he walks away. My heart's pounding through my chest, guys. It is just like, wow, this is amazing. And I start thinking of all of his fights and all of the spouts with Sonny Liston when he knocked out Sonny Liston. And I thought of the Joe Frazier fights. I was thinking of all of the fights. And so Dave's getting going. He flips the lights on. Oh, the lights are on. The rows of seats are behind me. I'm all wired up. I can hear the anchor. And I wave Ali over, and he comes back over, and I said, we're about 2 minutes away from Muhammad. We'll have about 5 or 6 minutes live with you. He said, okay. So he moves right in next to me. He's right here. And Paul Bloom throws it to me, and he says, well, you're never going to guess where Phil Stone is. He's at the sports arena, and you're really never going to guess who he's with. He's with the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali. Phil, what is going on at the sports arena? And I took the throw from Paul, and I'm just talking, and I said, well, Paul's right. I am with the greatest of all time, and what a thrill it is for me. Ladies and gentlemen, to my right is Muhammad Ali. And as I turned with the microphone to talk to him, all I see is a blur of a right fist coming right at me. And he does that, and he stops it so close to my cheek that I could feel my whiskers move. I mean, and I went, what do you do when somebody does that and you're not expecting it? You recoil. I went over these seats. And I'm laying on the floor, the concrete floor of the sports arena. And all I remember is I couldn't figure out how I got here. What just happened? So, and I hear this voice going, and Ali is trying to pick me up, and I'm trying to get up, and Dave is jumping over these two rows of seats to get me up, and he knocks the light over as he's jumping over the seat. It's chaos. My earpiece came out, so I'm getting up on my knees, and I'm kind of standing back up, and I'm plugging my earpiece back in, and I said, well, ladies and gentlemen, you remember more of this than I do, because I'm not sure exactly what happened, but I am with the greatest of all time. And Ali said, you got to learn to trust. And I said to Ali on live TV, I said, trust? I just want to make sure I'm still alive. And so that's how my interview with Ali started. Now we only had about 3.5 minutes with him. But it was one of those moments that's just tattooed on my heart forever. And every time I see anything that has to do with Muhammad Ali, I think about that moment on that Friday night in San Diego when he just literally rocked my world. So, well, I want to start, I guess, the nuts and bolts of my testimony today with something that the man who brought me to ministry said to me. His name is Pat O'Neill. He's the president emeritus of CBMC. I see a few heads shaking. You all know Pat. Pat is still with us. He's over in Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. And Pat said to me one day in 2008, shortly after I came aboard CBMC, you need to write your testimony out. And I said, a testimony? He said, yes, you need to write your life story out. And I said, what would that be for? And he said, that's going to be so that you'll have something to talk about when you go around the country. And if there are men from CBMC, they're going to want to know your story, and you ought to have it carefully crafted, and you need to be praying about it as you wrote it. So I want you to take 2 days off next week and disappear somewhere in the hills of North Carolina, and I'd like you to begin that thought process. And so 2 days off, not begin that thought process. So I did, and I began to craft my testimony, and I wrote it, and I wrote it, and I wrote it, and I kept writing, which I love writing, and I returned to the office a few days later, after messing with it some more, and I handed him about 15 pages, handwritten. And he read it, and he comes into my office that afternoon, and he takes it, and he tosses it back on my desk. And he said, that's not a testimony. And I said, well, it's my life story. He said, no, that's your PR story. That's your PR story. He said, something I've never forgotten, and I want to share with all of you. He said, this is everything that's good. This is the scrubbed and sanitized version of your life. Many more people that you will stand before, Phil, will identify with your failures more than they will your successes. And I said to Pat, I'm not sure I want to share all that stuff. He said, I'm pretty sure the Lord wants you to share all that stuff. So I took those 15 pages back. And I began to go through it again. I remember working on this guy's late into the night from my home in Raleigh, Durham. Late into the night, several nights, recrafting my testimony. And that's what you're going to hear today, is some of the good, some of the fun, and some of the tough patches. Tom briefly talked about one of the toughest patches of my life, probably the toughest, was losing my wife to cancer. And I'll share a little bit more. This is only the third time I've shared my testimony since Sandy has been gone, so I'll do my best when I get to that part to kind of keep it together. Still a little bit raw for me, but I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, born in Cincinnati. My mom and my dad divorced when I was a baby. I remember him a very little as a child, although I re-met him as an adult. But he was an alcoholic and worked for Delta Airlines, had a great job back in those days. My mom came into labor with me at Crosley Field at a Cincinnati Reds St. Louis Cardinals game. Got a Reds fan here. Yeah, I was born August 31st of 1947. The Reds were playing the Cardinals August 30th and promptly lost that game while my mom was in labor. And I went to the hospital, Deaconess Hospital in Cincinnati, which, by the way, that hospital's still open. And I was born at Deaconess Hospital in Cincinnati on August 31st of 47. So I guess it's no surprise that I would become a sports fan. I remember as I got older and they tore Crosley Field down, I said, Mom, did you buy any seats at Crosley Field when they tore it down? And she said, oh, heaven's sakes, no. Why would I do that? I said, because I was almost born there. I thought you'd have the foresight to buy half dozen seats. She just looked at me and shook her head. But I was serious about that. I said, man, I'd sure like to have some seats from Crosley Field. But that's long, long past. So I grew up in Columbus. My mom remarried. My stepdad, he was a tyrant. He was very tough to get along with. He was violent in his speech, but never physical. He was a hunter, as we were talking at our table. He loved hunting deer. Went to Michigan every fall to hunt deer. Never ever remember one time when he came back with one. I'm assuming he went to Michigan to play cards. But that was kind of my upbringing. So when I was in junior high school, I never liked going home much after school because I didn't want to be there with when if he was there and my mom wasn't there. I just didn't care for it. So I began to run down to Ohio State with my friend Jimmy Garrett, and we would start shagging footballs at practice. And Woody Hayes was the head coach there. Some of you may remember that name. And every fall, I would go down there every single day, and I would shag footballs. And I would do whatever Woody and the coaches and the trainers asked me to do, and Jimmy would do it too. We'd do it for two and a half hours, and we'd separate jock straps from socks when we were done, and then I'd run back home. And every now and then, when practice went from fall into the early winter, every now and then, Woody Hayes would say, "Young man, you have a ride home." I said, "Sir, I only live about a half a mile, so I'm fine. I'm fine just running home." He said, "Now, that's not what I asked you, was it?" And I said, "No, sir." He said, "You have a ride home." I said, "No, sir, I really don't." He said, "In 15 minutes, I'm going to give you a ride home." So every now and again, Woody Hayes would give me a ride to my apartment we were living in. And I was convinced he thought my name was Young Man, because that's all he ever said. That's all he ever called me over a period of 4 or 5 years, was Young Man. But I knew Woody Hayes far different from the way many of you might remember him, the tyrant on the sidelines. I knew Woody as a very loving, dedicated, ultra disciplinarian. But I learned a lot of life lessons from Woody that I didn't learn from a father, because I didn't have a father that I loved and respected. I had a tyrant for a stepfather. And I learned what hard work could do. I learned how much he loved those players, even when sometimes it didn't appear that he would. In fact, I have a good friend in San Diego. His name was Dr. Rich Richley. He's an orthopedic surgeon and a very good one. Rich went on to teach some back surgical procedures over in Europe in his later years. And Woody told me a story. Rich told me a story about Woody. He said, "Phil, I would not be where I am today without Woody Hayes." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Because when I played for him, even though I never played, the life lessons he taught me and the discipline that I learned is why I'm here today." And I'll tell you one thing very few people know. Woody went to the dean of the medical school in Columbus when I was a senior, and he pleaded with the director of medicine at Ohio State to let his player into the medical program. And he got in, and he excelled, and went on, as I said, to become a great surgeon. That's the kind of guy Woody was. If he believed in you, and you showed loyalty to him, he would go to the mat for you. And those are life lessons, guys, that I have learned. So I went on from high school, went into the service, served 3 years in the United States Army, and three other greatest years of my life. I'm one of the guys who, during the Vietnam conflict, have great stories to tell about my service career. I had a brother-in-law that didn't have such good stories, but I was assigned, went to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, was assigned to the Presidential Honor Guard in Washington, D.C. It's the same unit that the U.S. Army drill team's a part of, the U.S. Army band, the tomb guards are part of the same unit. It's called the Old Guard, the 3rd Infantry. I was a part of that same group. In fact, one night when I first got there, I was told that everybody who comes to the Old Guard has to go over to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and walk the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier for 15 minutes in the middle of the night, because they want to see if you have what it takes to be a tomb guard. So I went as an announcer. They needed announcers in that unit. They had two of us assigned to the unit, and we did a lot of ceremonies, and there were scripts attached to each one of those ceremonies. So I went as a 71R20, which is a broadcast specialist. So I really had no idea I was going to be walking the tomb. But one night, it would have been in October of 67, I walked the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier from about 2:30 at night to about 2:45, and was told that you would not be reassigned to the tomb. So. I had seen pictures of these guys walking the tomb in the snow and the rain and the storms, and great deal of respect. I knew a lot of those guys that did it. But again, it was another high water mark for me, men, of what it means to be dedicated to a cause. The guys that walk that tomb, they got what it takes. They take an oath of sobriety for the rest of their life. when they walked that tomb. An oath of lifelong sobriety. So that was my initial immersion into the Army. A year after I was assigned to that unit, I was reassigned to the Armed Forces Radio Television Network in Iran. And it's back when the Shah liked us, back when the Iranian people and the government liked what we were all about. And I was in Iran for a year and a half, then came back, finished my service career in Fort Ord, California. Enrolled at Ohio University rather than Ohio State because I had heard they had the best radio television department in the state. And I'm glad I did that. Kind of wanted to get out of the house. Didn't want to go back under the roof where my stepdad was after being in the service for 3 years. So went down to Athens, Ohio, completed my undergraduate and my graduate degree, and then decided to launch out into broadcasting. My first job was in Toledo. I was a booth announcer. The extent of my work in Toledo at that time was in between the programs, you'd hear a voice say, "The time is 12 o'clock, you're watching WSBD Television, Toledo, Ohio." Click. That was it. I did that for about a year, and then I had a guy reach out to me from WHOK Radio in Lancaster, Ohio. He said, "Would you like to come down and be an on-air personality in Lancaster?" I said, "Yes." Yes. So I did, and got down there, and had something I've never forgotten. We were airing a Cleveland Indians game on our station in Lancaster, and my job whenever we were doing a Cleveland Indians game was to do the same thing I did in Toledo. I mean, the guys are doing the game at Municipal Stadium in Cleveland, so when they would say it's the end of the sixth inning or the end of the seventh inning, now a word from our local stations. That was my cue to run the commercials. So I hit the little commercial cassettes. One of them didn't run. And it's just sitting there. And I'm punching it, punching, punching. It's not working. Pulled out, put another one. It's not working. It's the cassette. So I opened the microphone because it was just dead air. And I said, "This is WHOK in Lancaster, Ohio. We'll be back to the Cleveland Indians game in just a moment." I forgot to turn my microphone back off. And there's just this big red light in front of me as I'm looking around trying to figure out what do I do. And I said, for everybody in Southeast Ohio to hear, "Oh, I don't know what to do." Well, everybody heard that. Now I've got all kinds of lights lighting up. It's the phone lines. And I'm answering phones. I turn the mic off. And I hear these voices saying, "I just heard the funniest thing I heard on WI." I just click off and answer the next one. I had about 20 of those calls to field. And that was another life lesson then on be sure you treat every microphone in your life, including this one, as if it's live, because we never know. So those are some of the fun things that I experienced as a very young broadcaster. After I left WHOK, I got a position down in Jacksonville, Florida with WJXT Channel 4, and that was my first sports job. They asked me to come down and they'd like me to do weekend sports. I said yes. So I went to Jacksonville, Florida. And our news anchor down there was a guy named Bill Grove. And Bill Grove had this voice from God. I mean, it was a voice. And I said to our weatherman, I said, "I just cannot believe Bill Grove's voice." He said, "Does it sound like anybody else you know?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Does it sound like Walter Cronkite at all to you?" And I said, "It does kind of have those deep, rich Walter Cronkite tones." He said, "They're best friends." I said, "Walter Cronkite and Bill Grove are best friends?" He said, "Yeah, they went to college together." So about 2 months later, Walter Cronkite comes walking into our newsroom, and I'm like, oh, man. So there were some high water marks for me as I was a young broadcaster that I cued on and had the chance to chat with different people as I was coming up in that business that kind of set sail for me. I remember before leaving Ohio University, I had the good fortune of running into a guy by the name of Bob Coe. Bob Coe was vice president of ABC Sports sales unit. And Bob came down to talk to our graduate class about broadcasting and about network television. And I walked up to him afterwards and I said, "Mr. Coe, my name's Phil Stone." I said, "You know, it's I've been in the service. I spent 3 years there, sir, and I'm sending resumes out now." And I said, "Everybody wants experience. And how do you get experience if nobody will give you experience?" And Mr. Coe was 81 years old. His fingers were all yellow from smoking, and he held a cigarette between these two fingers, and he was shaking a little bit. And he's looking at me through his glasses, and eyes were a little watery, and he's kind of looking at me, and he said, "What did you say your name was?" I said, "My name is Phil Stone, sir." He said, "Phil, what you're describing to me is you're facing some walls every time you reach out, right?" And I said, "Yes, sir, that's exactly what it is." And he looks at me, and I'm telling you guys this story 50 years later. He said, "Phil, those walls are not there to keep you out of this business. They're here to judge how badly do you want in." Man, guys, that was huge for me. And I would say if there was one bit of advice that forged my life and has continued to forge my life, it's that. And he said, "You need to persevere." If I was a graduate student, I needed to go look up what that word meant. I had a good idea what it meant, but I wanted to know what Webster said persevere means. And it means just that. It's forging ahead when all seems lost, when everybody else turns away. And he said to me, he said, "You know, all these other people that are sending in these resumes are going through what you're going through. They're all going to turn and they're going to walk away from that opportunity. Because it's too tough. It's too tough. They're going to take the easy road. They're going to work at the liquor store. They're going to work at the delicatessen. But if you want in this business, by golly," he takes his finger and he punches right on my chest, "you be the one to persevere. You got that?" I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, sir." And I thanked him, walked away. And here I am in Chattanooga, Tennessee in 2025 telling you the same story that I heard in 1976. And I wonder how good are we as fathers and stepfathers of telling our sons and daughters and grandsons and granddaughters that very thing. "You know, Grandpa or Dad, it's just too hard. I just can't get in." Man, let's be that one person in their life who says, "Those walls in your life are not there to keep you out. Somebody's going to find their way over the wall. Make sure it's you." Man, guys. Now I'm going to bring you all the way forward. 1984, working in San Diego, living on Donington Way in my condominium. You take care of that condo the way I did? Okay, just checking. And my wife Paige came to me, a beautiful, beautiful young lady. And she said to me, "I want a divorce." And I said, "What?" She said, "I want a divorce. I'm not in love with you anymore, and I just need to go be single again. I'm a flight attendant. I want to be able to do all the things flight attendants do, and I just feel very restricted. And it's nothing you're doing. It's something inside me. I need to be divorced." So we moved to Rancho Bernardo area, San Diego, and Paige took off. Never once wavered. She was just gone. Her mom and dad said, "This is just a phase. We'll talk to her." Her two sisters and brothers said, "We don't know what she's going through, but don't worry about it." Well, they were wrong. She was just laser focused on getting divorced. So by the time we got divorced, I had a little baby boy who's now 44. And it was a harpoon in my heart, guys, that I just never, ever experienced and never thought I'd be in that position because I was a product of divorce as a boy, and I never wanted that for my kids. But sometimes we don't have the ability to reverse those ways. So I went through that divorce, and my kids came to live with me about 6 years later. I had a daughter at the time too, and my kids were living with me. And I was traveling the country doing sports at that time. NBC had come calling. Was doing, as Tom said, NFL football, Major League Baseball, NBA basketball, NCAA football, and was really living professionally a pretty great life. And I was a single dad living for my children and living for my career. And about 10 years later, 1994, I remembered feeling this feeling of, there's got to be more to this life. I mean, my friends and my relatives are telling me how great I am. I'm interviewing the best of the best. You helped Michael Jordan find his wallet at the United Center in Chicago one day. You're doing everything that you can possibly do, and you're loving it. How can you feel empty? And I said, I don't know. And so a couple of friends of mine, Tim Somerville, Bob Jewell, and Sherry Moulton, came to me in the span of 1 week in 1994 and said, you know, there's a new church in your neighborhood that you ought to consider going to. It's really neat. And I said, I don't think I need church. I said, church is for weak people. And so, well, you need to go find Christ. I said, I don't need the crutch. Jeez, I just didn't know what I didn't know, guys, because I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I didn't know what I didn't know. And so it was about a year later when I really began to turn up that flame a little bit, and I decided to go and try that church, and I did. And I sat in that church in fall of 1995 in the middle of my football season. And I laughed in that church, and I cried, and my son and my daughter were on either side of me. Brent at the time was 14, Lindsay was 11, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. Why am I having this reaction? And so I met a guy in church that day. His name was Paul Lewis, and he said, would you come to my office tomorrow? It's here in Rancho Bernardo. I'd like to get to know you. I've seen you on television, but I'd sure like to get to know you. I said, yeah, I'll come. I went to his office. And he said, so what's going on in your life? And I said, Paul, let me explain it to you this way. I'm in the middle of my football season, so I'm going to use football as a metaphor. I kind of feel like my life is at halftime. I'm at halftime of my life. And I've got my son and my daughter, my team, on either side of me, walking off the field at halftime. And I look up at the scoreboard, and I see that we've scored a few touchdowns, we've given up a few, we've turned the ball over, we've taken the ball away. And I said, Paul, I'm not sure at this moment of my life if I have enough left for the second half. I said, does that make any sense? And the most unbelievable reaction, he breaks into this huge smile. And I'm like, what is he smiling about? And he says, if I give you a book, would you read it? And I said, probably not. And he said, why not? And I said, because I'm in the middle of football season. I got media guides stacked from my floor to my ceiling of stuff I have to read. I mean, I just don't have time. He said, would you read 20 pages? I said, I don't think so. Now, this is a new friend. And he leans forward and he said, just 20 pages, for gosh sakes. I said, yes, yes. It was going to hit me like Ali, or I'm not sure what was going to happen. But I agreed to read the 20 pages. And he tossed me the book. And I'm sitting as close as I am to you. He tosses me the book, and I grabbed it, and I turned it over, and it says, halftime. Oh, wow. I see some heads shaking. I read that book. I took the book downstairs. One of the few days of the year was raining in San Diego, and I sat in my car with the windshield wipers, and I read the first 20 pages of the book with the engine running. And then I raced home that afternoon, and I read the rest of the book halftime. And it all began to clear up for me, men, that I was living a life of great success, but my significance quotient was empty. What was I doing to assure my kids that I would be leaving them a legacy that they could stand on and look back and say, our dad helped us create the foundation we have? I was a zero there. I wasn't doing bad things. I just wasn't doing anything intentional for Jesus Christ. The book Halftime caused me to really immerse myself in my church. I went to church a couple of weeks later, and I said, if there's any positions in the church, volunteer positions that I could fill, I'd love to do it. It was a new church, kind of a church plant. They said, could you take over the men's ministry? I said, probably not. That's a little bit more than I'm thinking. I was thinking maybe ushering. something I can get my arms around, dude. No. You'd be perfect. Everybody knows you. You'll get to meet everybody. You can help them in their walk with Christ. I said, who's going to help me? I don't even know where the books of the Bible are. He said, Phil, you will learn as much as you will teach. And Ken and Pam Ingold convinced me at their house with this big, huge cocktail table Bible on their table that in that book you will have all you need. That will be the manual that God will give you and encourage you to get into to lead the men's ministry. We went from 18 people in 1997 to about 130 in the men's ministry in less than a year. And we went to a retreat up at Forest Home where Billy Graham recommitted his life to Christ in 1961. And we took a lot of men up that hill to Forest Home. And again, that is where I had my first immersion into what it means to feel the presence of the Holy Spirit. It was during a praise and worship session. And I felt the warmth. It's almost like somebody put a hairdryer up to the back of my neck. And I looked around a couple of times and there's nothing there. And I am convinced that that was the first time I felt the presence of the Holy Spirit. And I felt it a number of times while I was up there with those men just like you, probably about the same number of men. And that rocked my world. So if you're not getting anything else from this, get at least this. There were moments in Phil Stone's life, good and not so good, that were key turning points in my life. One of them was shortly after that experience with the church, when I heard that there was an organization called CBMC. And I said, what is CBMC? It stands for the Christian Businessmen's Connection. They're a group out of North Carolina. They're looking for a national director of communications and marketing. And Bob Davey said, I think you ought to go online and take a look because you've done everything that they're looking for at a very high level. And I had just retired from broadcasting at that point. It was 1998 and I had stepped away after 31 years. I had just had enough. The athlete mentality was driving me nuts. The owners and the coaches weren't much better. So I just decided I needed to do something a little different. So I sent my resume to Pat O'Neill, the man I spoke of earlier. And lo and behold, he calls me 2 weeks later and says, Phil, this is Pat O'Neill in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina. I'm the president of CBMC. And I'm like, I said, Mr. O'Neill, could I call you right back? I'm on another call. Can I have your phone number? And he gives it to me. I looked up my phone. I saw it was on my phone. I said, give me 5 minutes. Well, I was so stunned that I was sure this was somebody that was pulling a prank on me. This was one of my buddies just pranking me. So I called the number back, and sure enough, he answers. And I said, I need to fess up. I said, I wasn't on the phone with anybody. I just wasn't sure this was you calling. And he starts laughing. He said, I appreciate your openness and honesty. And so we talked, and he said, listen, I'm looking over your resume. I've talked to my leadership team. We'd like you to fly in for a week. I said, a week? He said, yeah, we'll fly in from San Diego to Raleigh-Durham. We'd like to interview you for a week and see if you're the guy we're looking for. And I thought to myself, man, I've never been on a week-long interview in my life. So I flew in and interviewed, and lo and behold, they made a job offer, and I promptly turned it down. Wow. And Pat says to me, why are you turning this down? And I said, Mr. O'Neill, he said, call me Pat. I said, Pat, I'm not enough for this position. I just need to let you know that. CBMC needs somebody a lot more like Billy Graham than Phil Stone. And he said, that's not what the Lord's telling me. Yes, that's not what the Lord is telling our leadership team. You are the one we believe is the person perfectly suited for this. And I said, well, I need to pray about this, but for the right time, the answer is no. I can try and fool you, but I'm not going to try and fool Jesus. And he said, fair enough. He said, will you get back to me? I said, yes. And I did. I called him about 4 months later. I said, is that job still open? He says, it is. He says, but it's not a job. And I said, it's not a job? And he said, and that's a calling. And I said, okay, what's a calling? And he explained that to me. I said, see, I told you, you're looking for somebody a lot more like Billy Graham than me. So they offered the job again and the calling again, and I took it. And here I stand 17 years later before you. And you know, guys, I lived my dream. Tom's right. I lived my dream growing up as a young boy in Columbus, going through a divorce, and just loved what I did for so many years. And then going from appealing to crowds of millions, coming to CBMC and only appealing to a crowd of one. And his name is Jesus. That's the only person I really need to satisfy. It has been one of the greatest thrill rides of my life. Somebody asked me recently, would you ever want to go back and do it again? And I said, no. No. He said, boy, that's pretty definitive. I said, it is definitive. He said, why do you say no? And I said, because I'm one who believes, before I was a Christian, that luck played a great deal to do with my life. And so I'm going to just initially say, I don't think I'd be nearly as lucky if I went back and did it again. Because certain parts of what we do professionally, while we might want to say, it's all ordained by God and it's also ordained by how we prepared for that. But to me, there was some degree of luck involved in my broadcast career. Being in the right place at the right time, the right faces, looking at what you're doing, making the phone call, reaching you. There was just a lot of that going on in my mind. And then coming to ministry, no luck involved in that at all. I knew flat out that this was God's doing. And it took me a little while to figure it out. But to see all of you stand when we started, almost put a lump in my throat to see how many of you have been impacted by this ministry. I went to my first CBMC event before I was even a Christian. I'll just back up the train for just a minute. I was invited to go to a luncheon in San Diego, much like this. And I walked in with the area director. His name was Dick Bridgman. And Dick said, you might know a few of these people, Phil, or they'll probably know you from your work here. We walked into that hotel much like this, much just like this room. And I knew almost everybody there. And the ones I didn't know knew me from the exposure of television. And everyone who came up to me that I knew would say, I didn't know you were a Christian, Phil. And I said, I'm not. I said, are you? And they said, I am. And I'm going, this went on. It was like a minor bird for like 15, 20 minutes. Yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm not. Yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm not. And so I walked out of that luncheon head scratching, thinking to myself, there's a lot of people that I've known that I had no idea that were following Jesus. I mean, guys, I went to ball games with, I played golf with, we went on fishing trips with. I had no idea. But now I did. And that set in motion my desire to learn more about these guys and to involve myself with them at a little bit different level. And that's kind of what set the stage for me increasing my walk with Christ, my church experience, my taking over the men's ministry. All those things were carefully orchestrated, not by me. And that's just been a great ride ever since. Coming to national ministry and continuing to evolve, you know, into my role as working with men, that was all set back in the 1990s when I first realized I had something maybe to offer men, and that is just a handshake and a way of saying, come on, come on. Maybe you can change your life too. So I think I'm about out of time. All right. Well, men, we've got some cards on the table. Now, if you guys would pass around the envelope, I'd like you to just open these up. But guys, this is more than an exercise. This helps the leadership team here in Chattanooga reach out to you and get involved and just ask you some very simple questions. There's absolutely no pressure at all. They might ask you what you thought of the speaker. The answer to that question is he was marvelous. The other thing they might ask you if you'd like to have somebody reach out to you. And I would encourage you to say yes to that, men, because it just doesn't seem that long ago when I was at the place where you're at. Maybe wondering a little bit more about what would it be like if I gave my life to Jesus? What would it be like if I just got together with some of these men away from luncheons like this? I live here. My team, the National, Rob, and a couple of Johns here, one there, Mark. We all stand ready. Give us a call. Love to meet you for breakfast to share a little bit more about what we're all about. Who knows, if you got a condo for sale, I'll get you in touch with Roy. So, if you'll just go ahead and fill that card out and just, I'm interested in connecting with a Christian mentor. We, as I say, those of us on the national level as well as the local team, Doug White, he's ready, he stands ready to meet with you as well. I know Doug goes 24 hours a day, so you want to meet with him at 3 or 4 at a Cracker Barrel, you're ready for that, aren't you, Doug? He's absolutely ready. So peer advisory groups available to you. There's young professional groups if you're in your 20s or 30s or early 40s. Boy, find out about the YP groups because they are really, really tops. And if you just want to discuss any spiritual needs you might have, you're going through a point where you need some prayer, let us know about that. So I'll end with this while you're filling that out. You know, when we do an NFL game, we spend a lot of time preparing our open. It's the first thing you see when the announcers are standing in front of the cameras. We set the stage, and then they cut to the field, and it's kickoff time. There was a game that we were doing in Southern California back in the 1980s, and the Trojans of Southern California were ranked number 3 in the nation, and Oregon State was unranked. In fact, I don't think they've ever been ranked. But 2 years prior to this game, Oregon State upset Southern California up in Corvallis. And Dave Rowe and I were getting ready to do the game. And here's the open I wanted to do, but discretion being the better part of valor, I steered clear. But here's, and Dave and I have joked about this for years, here's what I wanted to do that day. I'll probably stumble through this because I haven't thought this for a while. Hi, everybody. I'm Phil Stone, along with Dave Rowe. Today on NBC, it's the Trojans of Southern California, ranked number 3 in the country, against the Beavers of Oregon State. Well, Dave, this is going to be one heck of a game, but I'll tell you one thing. I know the Beavers beat the Trojans 2 years ago up in Corvallis, but this time around, there's a better chance that Jesus will come back than the Beavers winning this one. Thanks for your time, man. Thank you.